All right, guys, welcome to episode 2 of Thoughtful BS with Tofu and Nate. We're going to be talking about True Detective season 2, episode 4 today. We're finally at the halfway point. And I don't know, a lot of interesting things happened last night, for better or for worse. I enjoyed everything, and I think you're finally 100% on board this wild ride.
Yeah, I would say I'm 100% maybe on board, but that doesn't mean I'm going to like the destination necessarily, if that makes sense. Like, up till now, I wasn't even sure if I was on board with it. I'm invested in it now.
Gotcha.
And like, I don't know, and I like this episode, unlike actually it seems like a lot of people based on the critical online reaction. I like this episode more than the past few, but I'm still, you know, it wasn't an all-time favorite hour of television for me or anything like that.
For sure,
But I liked it, and it made me far more curious to see where the season's going to go for a few different reasons. And I think it was for me a lot more than just the firefight at the end.
Yeah. Well, was it more so that I definitely could see that that critical reaction being somewhat like overall as an episode, you know, had some weaker points, but it definitely did a good job of tying everything we've seen before together.
You mean just because
the previous three episodes just felt very well disseminated by this episode?
Like, you mean because the way the three characters survived the firefight at the end,
or correct.
In other ways as well?
Well, more so, again, like it really hammered in, you said that,
right,
that theme about parenting,
right.
But also in the sense that there was this very, I don't want to use the word claustrophobic, but there's that still very overarching feeling of like, yo, what is the state? What is the government? What is the, you know, police's involvement in this?
Right.
And the fact that this episode ended with such a violent firefight in which what I assume a lot of the officers of Vinci PD have now all been brutally murdered.
Right.
That to me helps focus the story more.
Yeah.
Right.
No,
now,
we still
have
definitely
two lenses.
Well, And
Vince, you know, Vince Vaughn's lens,
right?
The three detectives, and then this loose idea that there's no way this story is over, because judging from, you know, the previously next week, it seems like it could have been like last season. They're like, oh, he's gone, but it, you know, and then they kind of have to revisit.
What do you
that.
Mean when he's gone?
Well, remember how the whole big thing about last season was they thought they got him.
Oh, right. Okay, sorry.
I got confused by the pronoun. Oh, yeah.
Sure what you meant by.
And they expanded that, you know, for a huge time, you know. A huge
right.
Time
well, scale. That's, I guess that's my, one of my questions is there going to be a time jump after this episode? And not to give any spoilers, but the preview didn't strongly suggest it, but it could definitely be interpreted. When I say that, I'm talking about the next week, you know, the next week on True Detective. I think mainly the references to the shooting, the way they referred to it, and the fact that Colin Farrell didn't have the mustache anymore. You can easily just shave a mustache.
Could
be 12 hours later.
Things too, like, you know, Annie was not in a plainclothes detective uniform anymore. She was in the sheriff's department.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of times I get excited about that, but usually it's like, oh, it's a formal occasion, so she had to wear the outfit.
And it would also make sense on a few other levels, in addition to the fact that, like, just from a writing perspective, that you would miss some of the logistical. I mean, I'm sure that there's interesting elements you could incorporate as a writer into it, but I'm sure there's lots of, you know, in order to follow some degree of realism, logistical fallout from this nightmare shootout.
Exactly.
That's like,
that you don't want, you know, the start of next episode to
just be
like
all
headlines.
What happened. And then so you have that, you have the fact that Rachel McAdams had just been suspended,
mm-hmm.
you know, for an indefinite period of time. So, you know, that gives a reason to skip forward and see where she is a little while from then. And you also have the Vince Vaughn proposing to Colin Farrell to come work for. I'm so, the funny thing is, I'm so bad with the characters' names this season. I'm calling them by their.
I
know Annie, and it's A-N-I, right?
Yeah, because it's short for something like really
right,
straight.
Right.
Like something like Greek.
And then it's, is it, Colin Farrell is Ray.
Ray Velcoro.
So
he's
Ray,
really
I
the
remember,
only one I've met.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And then.
What is Vince? I should know this.
Vince Vaughn's character's name is.
It's embarrassing. I mean, it's online.
Yeah, I always forget it. Because they don't say it too often, except, like, when he's about to, like, fight somebody.
Right.
Oh, my God. What's even worse is I don't know the name of his girlfriend either.
Yeah, I mean, I just know her. Yeah, the actress' names. Do you think that's a reflection of the writing? Do you think at this point we should know the characters' names more than we do, or do you think it's just us?
I don't think it's too much the writing. I think it's more the fact that we were already so hyped on the show. We were already theoretically talking about everyone's character before we actually knew them.
Right, and so we were just calling them Colin Farrell, yeah. Vince Vaughn,
Rachel McAdams. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So that makes sense to me. And so those are a few reasons that I could see us returning. You know, 6 months, 1 year, 2 years down the road. You know, maybe 2 months, and you know where now Colin Farrell has taken Vince Vaughn's offer to help him.
We don't have to see like three episodes of let me try and recreate my empire. Like
right, which could really lead to the second half of the season being far more compelling than the first, and really that the first was the setup.
Right,
and I mean for me, the other thing about the first that I realized last night, maybe it was during the third episode. And this makes sense. I mean, there's a few ways it's like Game of Thrones, and this makes sense, especially it's on HBO. But one of the things about the first season that was bugging me a little that I realized is very much like Game of Thrones is the fact that for the first three episodes, not only did you have these very disparate plots that like were sort of connected, but were not really. You'd follow Colin Farrell in sort of for a minute, and then you'd follow Taylor Kitsch. And do you know what I mean? Like, whereas most TV shows are far more intertwined with the characters. And the way they were so separate reminded me of Game of Thrones, along with the fact that there weren't these episodic arcs that you see on shows like The Americans.
Right.
Or even Breaking Bad. I'm trying to think of some others, but
argue Mad Men too.
Mad Men, I'd say Mad Men has episodic arcs, but that so Game of Thrones is much more about the larger picture, and the episode might have a bit of a theme running through it, or a bit of like pacing running through it. But like, there's not a story that's sort of told within the episode. The episode is part of the because most of the time with TV you have sort of smaller story or stories that happen within the episode.
Right, and you have a longer arc. I get that.
And for this, it seems like the first three episodes didn't have their own stories. They were just part of this big. That's why it reminded me of Game of Thrones.
Okay,
it felt like these disparate stories with this lack of episodic arc that were part of this huge scope.
I mean, I can see that, but honestly, the nice part about the first season of Game of Thrones is that it doesn't do that as often.
Right, I guess, yeah. It didn't remind me of the first season of Game of Thrones. It reminded me of Game of Thrones now,
or Game of Thrones
a year ago. Yeah.
This season, well, that's a whole other podcast. But I definitely see that, and I think, and this is, of course, going back to Nick Pizzolatto being the auteur of this. He says you have to look at it as a whole season. You can't look at it
episodic. Oh, he said that?
Yeah.
Yo, I'm not surprised at all.
And, you know, like you just said, the generic way to look at, not generic, but the standard practice way is like, no, TV is pretty episodic, and we've kind of started adding these sub-narratives, especially on networks as well. But definitely, I don't know. What is your opinion on telling your audience? Because that's what does it for me. It's like one thing if I pull that out of what I'm seeing, but to say just boldly to a critic, like, no, you have to look at the whole season. You can't look at individual episodes because then you're not going
to... To me, this show was so... I mean, and I would say that's the same with Game of Thrones. Even with the whole season, it's hard to see because even then, there's not really a season arc. Game of Thrones is just this one giant series arc that's slowly progressing. But for me, I mean, with this and with Game of Thrones, it was so clear to me that, like, well, I was thinking, like, episode one or episode two, like, you know, shit, I can't judge this as an episode because it's not really an episode. It's just part of a larger story. And so, I guess I don't have a problem with him saying that, at least for me, because in this instance, it was so apparent. I mean, it is a little defensive, but it also makes me optimistic that this season's going somewhere good, that because he didn't have to pitch it with a great, you know, oh, here's the great first three episodes, you know, arc of how this, because even Breaking Bad, which goes somewhere great at the end, you know, really builds to an epic ending, has these first three episodes where have these sort of great arcs and are individual sort of stories where he, you know, he has this guy trapped in the basement of his house and, you know, and so because it was so apparently that, I guess I don't have a problem. I mean, it is interesting when you get into, though, I mean, the whole, then you get into literary theory in terms of to what degree, I mean, usually the idea is that you should, you know, I mean, generally speaking, look at the text and not, I mean, well, context can help with the text, but, you know, you're not going to, just because the author says something, that's not necessarily how you should read it. But it's weird when with TV where the authors actually, or the writers, you know, actually saying, you know, actively saying, you know, let's look at it this way, rather than like, you know, someone arguing in an English class. Oh, at one point, you know, later in his life in an interview, the author mentioned this, and therefore it means the text means this. Exactly. This is far more active on the author's part.
And actually, I just thought of this. Mm-hmm. You know what that reminds me more of than any other show? Literally any other show.
What this
kind of idea of like you have to look at an entire season, not as arcs within a season or sub arcs within a season, as literally one massive volume.
One show. I would say Game of Thrones. So I'm curious what you're gonna say.
The Wire.
Oh, really?
Honestly, I didn't really like that show until episode 5, and then I was like, oh my god, this show's
amazing. Episode 5 or series?
Episode 5 of the show, The Wire. Oh, I was hooked by season 2. It's just like,
It took you some time.
After we watched, like, I thought, like most shows, episode 1 is going to be boom. Right. I am sucked in. Yeah. No, I know everyone's
for sure.
name.
For sure.
Clearly, from True Detective, I don't know anyone's
name. Yeah. Wire is hard. There's so many names.
But I wasn't. And I also feel that is another show because the thematicism of a season is just so strong and, like, entirely just unfolds across the entire season. I would say that's a hard series to also look at episodically in the same more like standard sense you would look at a show. Like we said, like The Americans or Mad Men.
Yeah.
But that just leads me to question, would then a series like True Detective, or at least this season, because it seems there was a little more like mystery, like stronger dramatic like beats for an audience to receive from last season, would it benefit from kind of doing a more Netflix formula and be like, hey, it's or like the miniseries formula, let's release this all at once.
It's funny you mentioned that because I was actually thinking about that last night in terms of how, because I would argue, I would actually say House of Cards even, and actually especially Orange is the New Black, have more of episodic arcs than True Detective it does.
Yeah.
But House of Cards sometimes, they're much more subtle. They are there, but because it is meant to be binge watched that way, they're less. It's more part of the whole season rather than. I mean, there's these set of small episode arcs, but they're not as prominent as other series. And so, actually, last night while I was thinking, I actually thought, because I'm someone who's, I've started to, as a lot of people, there've been more online op-eds sort of questioning the binge watching and are there negative sides to both as a showrunner in terms of publicity. You know, in terms of the way Game of Thrones builds, where everyone the next one day is talking about the same thing everywhere.
Can't even go on Twitter if you haven't seen it.
Exactly. And so a lot of people recently have been saying, oh, you know, maybe binge like, not watching, but binge releasing, at least releasing all the episodes at once, like Amazon has done.
Netflix
has done. Shows Netflix has consistently done, except for one new show.
Between.
Where they're trying to.
But it's Canadian, and it was terrible.
Okay, I don't know much about it. Anyhow.
Oh my God.
It started to be, people viewed it more skeptically, but I was actually, last night, it's funny you asked that, because last night while we were watching, I thought, you know, I'd be so down for the next episode right now, and wait a second. These first three episodes would make more sense if they were, like, all available to me at once. And it was just part of this larger story. Yeah. Because what that does is it does what Nick
Pizzolatto
said in his statement. It just does it. You don't have to come out and say it. It does it through the way it's distributed. By releasing them all at once, it says these are a huge thing.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe take each one.
What I thought was, like, you know how this is the first one, this is the first episode we've ended with, like, an actual freeze frame tableau?
Right, yeah.
Like, you know, like, we're halfway through.
We'll come back on this. Okay. You say what you're saying.
I was going to say is, in that sense, like, what if you released it, like, at a half point? Like, if I had the access in 1 week to watch all four of these first episodes, like, it's like
right.
True Detective Season 2, like,
Part one,
which, right. Oh, God, I hate that. Maybe, yeah, like, me Volume too. 1.
But that would be equally as bad.
Yeah.
I get what you're saying.
But, I mean, I would be, like, very, very down for that because, I don't know, like, again, you know how we kind of talked about the Ray being shot thing feeling a little cheap?
Yeah.
I don't think that would have been an issue because then...
You would have immediately went to the next episode. You immediately went to the next,
you don't have an entire friggin' week to overanalyze
right,
the scene.
Right, yeah.
But, I mean, I don't know, that's also part of the fun. So, it's a twist and pull. Honestly, from a business standpoint, it makes zero sense to me that HBO should have released that, all at once, from a business standpoint.
Right, right. No, it makes sense, especially because the way they've worked, especially with, like, Game of Thrones as of late, is this, you know, sort of buildup of suspense and online buzz and anticipation.
Yeah, and I mean,
theorizing,
like, I hate being that guy.
And same with the way the first season of True Detective was. Right. It would have not been a thing if it had been released all at once, because people got obsessed with the Yellow King.
And people, like, a year later probably would have been talking about, like, oh, did anyone actually watch this weird series, released all at once, randomly last spring?
Oh, it was all right, you know.
But, and the main thing is, every week, how many headlines now have to feature the name HBO True Detective?
Right, you know, exactly. So, you get more press.
Because, like, I just think about it right now, how long did we talk about Orange is the New Black as a, like, culture? Like,
right.
From this past season, very little.
Very little.
For,
no,
like,
exactly.
5 days.
Yeah, because it's there, and people talk about it, and then, like, people still off and on continue to talk about it, but no one knows, like, oh, has this person seen it? Have they seen the whole thing yet? Are they behind on it? You know, have they watched the first few seasons?
Right. And I think we should jump into a little more episode scene. Let's do a scene-by-scene breakdown a little
bit.
Yeah,
episode 4. Yeah.
But I did want to ask you this question. As, you know, someone who views TV, film, etc., as from a more critical standpoint,
right,
a more involved standpoint, does the weekly release formula work better for you in terms of your enjoyment, or does the binge watch release formula work mostly because the average person who's not following the criticism, not following as much of the culture, they don't care, and that massive release for them is awesome.
Oh yeah.
So I was saying, like, from more of, like, an involved standpoint, do you like that? That's the way the culture works in the scene.
Not
you have to wait weekly, talk about it. You know.
Not to give a wishy-washy answer, but it really depends. And here's why. And so you can name a show, and I'll tell you which I would prefer for a particular show. But the reason it depends for me is because it depends on a lot of things. Like, for something like Mad Men, even though I binged initially when I first saw the show and binged the first 3 seasons or 3.5 seasons, I still absolutely loved it. But those episodes, they're so rich, and there's so much to be savored, and there's so many moments, and you can watch them again and keep picking out new things because of all the little nuances, that's one that, you know, really makes sense to me to be spread out, because you need time to, it's one
process.
You really need time to process and digest, and if you want, you know, revisit, because sometimes I have, you know, more and more entertained actually by rewatching the past episode of Mad Men than I would be by rewatching the next episode of Mad Men. But, you know, then some of the shows I've had the most, but on the other hand, some of the shows I've had the most fun watching are been ones I've been binge watched. Either,
like,
I mean, most of the time, either on old DVD or on HBO Go, but they've been shows that I didn't know exist, or, you know, that I got into them either after they were no longer on air or while they were, you know, halfway through their run or something and got to binge watch on Netflix or on DVD. I mean, the first shows, TV shows I ever, that were network dramas that I ever really got into, like Alias, Lost, and 24, and even Heroes was one of the earlier ones.
Yeah, and that's
those,
super reliant on
Heroes
to come out weekly.
Yeah, yeah. Heroes, I guess I watched weekly, and Lost I actually did too after the first season, but Alias and 24 at least, and the OC, which I will defend.
I love the OC,
at least
season one.
Those I loved binge watching and benefited greatly from binge watching, and the sort of way you get invested in the stories, but also just sort of surrounded by the world and drawn into the world.
Sorry about that.
And
popular guy.
Yeah, I know. And so,
I understand. I completely understand in the sense that my top three things I probably binge watch are like teen drama.
Right. No, that makes drama, sense. Teen
drama, comedy shows, and then anime.
No, I can understand that.
So, yeah, let's go with it now. I would say from an artistic standpoint, when you have a drama, when you have a lot like of depth in your series, the weekly release is definitely very beneficial to both you as a producer as well as your audience,
and the legacy of the show. I'd argue,
of course,
because there's just more time it's on people's mind. Because for me, I mean, I don't love House of Cards. I like it, but say for example, Orange is the New Black, which I actually like more than House of Cards. I get like at least I'm less into it now than I was the first two seasons. But first season got so obsessed with it, was so into it, watched it for a week, and then just forgot about it for most of the year. And same with Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Daredevil, I watched that in like a weekend,
and then just is off your radar. And so like in terms of a lasting cultural impact, to me the classic week by week television serialization really does make sense. But gosh, sometimes it can be so great to binge things.
Oh my god, yes. It's the best part of streaming television. Yeah. As well as pirating things from back in the day.
I mean, last night, if we could have just said, if it was like, would you like to watch the next episode of True Detective? I would have been like, yes.
If it asked, would you like to pay $5 to watch it?
Yeah,
I would have been like, $5, $2.50 a person, that works out. No, I'm gonna really enjoy it until 2020, especially as the online battle for media commences. How the various non completely digital networks are gonna tackle that. That being said, all I can think about from last night is that stupid firefight, which wasn't stupid. I can see people seeing it as like a little unnecessary, but I thought it added to the whole like, oh cool, we're watching True Detective kind of mentality.
Right.
But I can see why last night's episode doesn't stick out in people's minds, because the one-on-one scenes weren't necessarily as interesting, and B, it didn't they were, I would argue, more straightforward. There was a little less up to interpretation. And frankly, honestly, my favorite one-on-one scenes so far have mostly been Vince Vaughn and Ray Velcoro, Colin Farrell's character.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Vince Vaughn and Kelly Riley. But yeah, I mean, for me, it's funny. The reason I know, at least some of the recaps and reviews I've read, that some critics didn't like the Firefly. But in addition to it, really, and this was the immediate thing I noticed, because even before it started, when I knew there was going to be some sort of, at a certain point they were going in, and I was like, there's going to be some sort of shootout. I didn't know it was going to be that much of a bloodbath, but I knew there was going to be some sort of shootout, and it immediately draws comparisons, as everyone else in the internet community has noted, to the end of the first season of True Detective. So, True Detective episode 4, also halfway through, where with the raid to grab the drug dealer and the epic 6-minute shot of them going in and the whole sequence. And obviously this is a different version. I thought this was great too in its own way. I guess I also know people who felt that it didn't feel like earned, or that if the episode had ended without that the episode would not be good. That it was at least it was doing what I would call the red wedding-ing, which is, in my opinion, Game of Thrones season 3, not that good. But it stuck the red wedding on at the end of episode 9. Everyone forgot the rest of that season was not that good.
Interesting.
Through, if that makes sense.
Well, that's
because
funny.
It was so epic and so good. It just erased everyone's mind to the fact that nothing had happened at all on that show for the previous 9 episodes.
Got it. To be not a non-book reader, because I wish I was that. Because I love, honestly, my favorite part of the now I'm trying to think of the whole season versus the episode. But
you can't, because nothing happened.
Well, I mean, I you're right. But I just remember, really, really, really like that entire episode, not just the red wedding scene. But That was another.
Oh no, that was a good. It was a good episode. Yeah, no, I'll give it.
I definitely teared twice, three times during that episode.
It was a good episode with an epic ending. But that episode, I mean, that whole season hinges on that episode. When I say Game of Thrones season 3, what do you think about?
that's fair. I mostly think about from episode 7 onwards.
Right. Yeah. Like, I guess that's fair enough.
Because there's a lot of walking.
Yeah,
a lot of walking that season. and of course the only other really good thing, Diana Rigg.
Right.
Queen of Thorns. Right. Just being quippy. Yeah. But
so I mean,
all right. In that sense, for the episode, then it felt that way. But again, going back to the whole looking at the four together,
right?
Without that, I would not care anything about what has happened,
right? As much. No, for sure. I guess for me, I actually really liked the Firefly fight. I mean, I'd be interested to revisit it, but the shootout definitely worked for me. But I guess I was trying to explain at least my understanding of why a lot of people weren't crazy about it is because it was like, sure, it was a well-executed scene. Well-executed scene, but like, it's just like it was just strung on to the end of a mediocre episode in order, you know, it's a lot of people's feelings.
I disagree
because I got more into Kish's character this time than I have been before. I got interested in the Colin Farrell, Ray and Vince Vaughn. Gosh, I feel so pathetic. Not, you know, we're podcasting about it and we don't know the characters' names, but you know, I'm going to blame this one on Nick. Oh, I don't even know the writer's name. I don't even know the writer's name. But, you know, yeah, I mean, I think for me, it was also that it had sort of been apparent before, but I don't think I'd realized till this episode how much this season was about, sins of parents being passed down, and also and just sort of the relationship between parents and children on both ends,
and the idea, the
Vince Vaughn, of the stories he tells about, you know, he's young, but then you also have this talk about her being pregnant, and then each of them have their own, you know, Taylor Kish is the mother and then the girl who he just got pregnant. And so there's this continuous sort of parents and children thing that's been strung throughout the season, especially with regards to just you know, evil and good being passed down.
My big thing about this season as well, just beyond that, and this falls directly under this category, but legacy. Like,
you know. Yeah, oh, totally.
And the constant, like, what does it mean? Like, I'm not going to be here anymore, yet I still care so, so much about what I leave in this world. And honestly, what made... and you can see it in literally every single one of their faces in that firefight.
Right,
that it's not just intense, I gotta stay focused and shoot. Intense, I gotta stay focused and shoot. It's like shit. We're like dying. What the fuck is going on? Like, there's so much desperation on each one of their faces that I was like, this is great. This is great. Especially after this. Look at all the different stakes that are on the line. If she died, she's going to go out as the bitch cop who was under investigation for sleeping with a subordinate. And it's just like, I don't, you know, she's like, goes into Farrell that, what else do you have to
prove? Exactly like it was at the end of episode 2.
Exactly. But, I mean, you know, even in that episode, he tried his best to, like, we see a little bit of closure with this. It's like, it's almost like in every episode, except for three, he's seeking a little bit of closure in his life, saying, God, I need something to keep going.
Yeah.
And all that is like, I don't care about my body. I don't care about my life. I just care for the one good thing that I can leave here.
Right.
And then, of course, you get, this is the worst, we don't know Taylor Kish's character's name.
Oh, it's fine. I'm pulling it up anyway.
We see him desperately trying to figure out who he is.
Right.
And I feel like, and that's why it's such a great scene when he says, I want to get married. Because it's just like, dude, you're lying. You just keep lying to yourself about what you want.
Right.
And what you think, and what you think people need to see you as.
Yeah.
And that to me is one of my favorite themes from this season, especially because last season, the main character, Rust, was so disinterested in that entire concept of human society, perception and legacy. Cause like, you know, it doesn't matter, man. Like, why would we be gone anyway? That kind of, you know, it's literally an opposite shift from that. which I really like, but playing with the same fundamental ideas, just, you know, conversely.
No,
I mean, contrastingly. God, I need to learn how to speak English.
Totally. And, yeah, I mean, for me, I think I could just, I had started to finally get more interested and invested during this episode, and then sort of the firefight was not something that came out of the blue just for shock value or entertainment value or to give us something to discuss, though it certainly did that, but it also, it was right when I finally, for me at least personally, started to have stake in the story, and so it just sort of took what I had and just sort of ramped it up because of the, you know, what was going on. And the funny thing, actually, I was thinking during it, you know, oh good, finally Justin Lin's action skills
are coming in handy.
But what I found out after, Justin Lin, for context, directed the Fast and Furious 5 and 6,
as well as Tokyo Drift. And he's been directing them since Tokyo Drift.
Did he do the fourth too?
Yeah, which was so, not good either.
So then how did he really? It was really with 5 and 6 that he revamped Fast and Furious.
So like quick Fast and Furious history here, just because I find it interesting.
Yeah,
Justin Lin literally revised the franchise with Tokyo Drift,
right?
And was like, okay, we need to make this more about characters and just kind of build something other than just fast cars and boobs.
Right.
So that's why he added this more like heist element to the fourth movie, and it didn't play out as well. And the franchise literally was going to die.
Right.
But Paul Walker is really into cars. And when, you know, I think brokered a deal with the studio where he'd get a lot of benefit from this next movie. And Justin Lin, okay, we learn from 4, we learn from 3, let's create the empire.
Right.
And essentially, the best description of them ever, they're comic book movies.
Yeah, no, they are. I mean, they're great. They're great fun. They're like, I mean, they're a little tongue-in-cheek, but they're so entertaining.
Yeah. And,
but anyhow, so...
But what was... He didn't direct that sequence?
So I guess, and this is fascinating to me, because I didn't know this till now, that I think it was, and then it rung a bell once I saw it, I think Justin Lin, he might be directing the finale or something, but I think he directed the first 2 episodes of this season. He did not, what I do know for a fact right now, that I have a source in front of me for sure, is that he did not direct that last night's episode. So, and it was a guy who's done some other, you know, not a named director you would know, but he's someone who's done some, you know, other TV and a couple of movies. But what's interesting to me, though, is that this season, because a huge aspect of the first season was that whole, like, auteur image of this whole show was directed by one guy.
Yeah.
And so this vision was consistent. And, I mean, the TV shows often have consistent visions and are not directed by the same person. Exactly. So it's not like that's not possible, but it is interesting for a show that had been, you know, had a sole director to switch to this.
I want to look that up.
Yeah, we should definitely talk about that
talk about that next week. Because if he directed the first 3,
mm-hmm.
that to me would definitely indicate why, like, narratively, so or, like, within the scene, some of the acting fell a little flat in this past episode.
Yeah.
That is fascinating. Because I definitely was under the impression... Oh, wow, we're terrible at this. I was definitely under the impression he was going to direct the whole season. But okay.
And then...
That's something to look out for.
I like the freeze frame at the end. I usually hate freeze frames. I find them corny and cheesy. But, I mean, there's a couple, you know, a couple old Japanese movies, Ozu films, where I can... Or the end of freeze frames where I find it to be powerful and moving. But I really like this because it seemed... It was like this huge like sigh after this, oh fuck, and it just froze.
Yep.
And it worked for me. And also, especially if there's a time jump, it works even better because it sort of pinpoints the end of this first half.
As well as it pinpoints within the world they created, this as a traumatic, life-changing point as well. Like, right. I could very easily see, you know, the next episode we get like, I really hope he doesn't use a montage, but instead, in lieu of, like, the quick network montage, like, oh, 3 shot and killed in confusing firefight on the streets of Vichy, and then, like, a cutover. It's like, unknown sources say the mayor's office, blah, 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 you know.
Right,
I'm really hoping the intro to the next episode, we're going to visit all of our 3 characters, maybe... I want to give it 6 months to a year down the line.
That sounds about right.
And, oh, that was my bad, guys. Sorry about the table shake. And then we hear, and then you hear, like, you know, he has the TV on in the background or a radio on in the background. And it's like, you know, the mayor's office still under investigation. Like, that to me would just feed the world.
It's better written exposition, too. It's double up on stuff. But I guess, It's a couple more final things. We should speed it up, though. I guess my final question to you is more of a foreshadowing one. They've went out into the country a little bit with the sort of commune that Annie's father is involved in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, that's one thing I love about I love how convoluted this mystery is right now. Because to me, the best mysteries are always really convoluted. You know, The Big Sleep or Chinatown or even more recently Inherent Vice or The Long Goodbye. Like, there's all these pieces and it doesn't quite make sense. Because right now we have like these factories down south. We have this commune up north. We have this transportation system. We have like some water involved.
Right.
Corruption in the city. And you have all these pieces and it's not quite sure yet how they remotely fit together, and I sort of love that.
Mm-hmm.
But really quickly, so going off the sort of stuff that's out more rural, the end, both some images in the opening title sequence suggest, but especially the final three images of the opening title sequence are rural, and the final, mm-hmm. like, they're woods, and the final one is just this wooded path in the middle of the woods. Do you think we're going to end up this season later more out in the rural, sort of middle of nowhere, either Sierras or maybe not that far out, but, mm-hmm. you know, somewhere that's not Vinci or Los Angeles.
Yeah,
do you think we're going in that direction?
I do.
Especially last season, too.
I definitely do.
Took that route.
Oh, that's my favorite part of last season.
Right,
just
yeah.
lost in the bayous. Like,
right,
the crazy
yeah,
wilderness
yeah.
of Louisiana.
Right, yeah.
And the fact that they still call everything parishes there.
Right, yeah.
But I wish I could say what you said totally, totally on board with.
Right.
But I wish I could say the details I'm about to share with you are wholly original. They're not. I found a great article about this by Molly Lambert,
uh-huh.
who was pointing out the secret society.
Oh, right.
She like was really, really harboring on the whole secret society concept of this idea. Mostly because she was pulling. Oh, God, I wish I had the source better, but the town it's based on. Above that, there's also another town that is this club. I forget what it's called, but it is kind of a secret society for like the rich and famous, you know. And
right.
you get a touch of that in like the Tuttle world from last season. But that to me is the perfect place to set up like a rural setting because you have all
yeah.
this open land. It feels creepy. And then, of course, hunting.
And that goes in line with the one sort of. I'm not going to say it, but it's rumor/spoiler that I think the Hollywood Reporter reported on earlier this year regarding a certain scene that was being filmed.
Oh, okay.
But definitely secret society issue, and it would also connect the two. I mean, it would start to give, in other than sort of this thematic darkness and nature of, you know, the evil and good and just the evil that exists in the world, it would also give True Detective more of a thematic link seasonally
mm-hmm.
if there's this connection to not just this hidden evil, but these sort of, not necessarily cults, but I don't know.
Well, it pulls it back more, like the nice thing about True Detective season one is it's not at all about organizations, it's about journeys,
right.
individuals, and just one man's, you know,
right,
not one,
yeah.
but like the depravity of this one crazy individual who's just been able to hide under like the whole mystery of a Southern Gothic.
Right, right.
Whereas this is definitely about like groups, like organizations
oh, yeah,
of people and
yeah.
other than parents. And I think if they do a secret society kind of thing, that'll really hammer that point in to separate it really nicely from, or not separate, just contrast it to
right.
season one
yeah.
more. What I really realized this episode though, from more of looking at the series and like, oh, so where's the detective work going on kind of standpoint is I love now, because before I not at all was super interested in the gangster Vince Vaughn story. God,
right.
I don't know his name. But now that I'm seeing him like kind of stitch back together his criminal organizations,
yeah.
I kind of like the convoluted detective work of trying to figure out how deep this guy was, as well as the fact we still don't know what element in the show is specifically going after him.
Right.
And frankly, we got nothing, no sense of that this episode. But
right.
what we did get was a bunch of, well, literally we explored four or three of his previous ventures.
Right.
And that to me, I bet literally in two episodes when we get more info on the actual perpetrator of these attacks or these murders,
yeah.
it's going to be stitched into that patchwork of criminal organizations we've been seeing. And now that we're here, I'm excited about that.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't before, but now I guess I finally am. You're welcome, Will Husky. You've won me over. But, yeah, I would say I probably could go with the critics on the sense that episode overall wasn't amazing, mostly because, if you notice, we've really only been talking about the ending and it as a whole.
Right.
But I'm all for True Detective Season 2, Part 1.
Yeah, no, me too. And, yeah, no, I'm definitely, it got me, I mean, I'm still, you know, I wouldn't say I love this season at all, especially having not seen the rest of it. I wouldn't even go as far as to say I really like this season, but it definitely got me just more interested where it's going, so that was good.
Perfect. Well, since we have a little kitty visitor walking down the stairs, sorry if you hear some meowing. There it is. But you know what? We didn't watch too many other things together this week. I just thought we'd do a little bit of fun announcements since we're full on in summer mode, as well as Comic-Con just aired. I have a few announcements. I was wondering if you wanted to end it.
Yeah.
Say anything else about you had anything interesting that you saw recently?
I don't think I have, unfortunately, much.
Okay.
That's interesting.
No worries. Well, it'll be interesting to see how you react to all of this really exciting news that I'm very happy about.
Yeah, what's your news?
But so the big issue, I think, recently, that was my bad, was Suicide Squad released some footage at Comic-Con.
It's a trailer, isn't it?
Yeah, that eventually got leaked. That has now just been officially released because it was leaked from Comic-Con. Being in charge of publicizing, it's just be a nightmare now. It's like, God, do we do it? Or like... Had that happened, I feel like, last year.
Yeah, it did.
With Game of Thrones footage.
Was it Game of Thrones? I thought it was a movie.
Oh, no, sorry. This spring, Game of Thrones released, like, a little teaser at, like, a convention, and it just got onto the internet very pirated, and HBO was like, God damn it, fine. Well, since everyone's watching this, you might as well watch it in high quality.
Right,
so,
yeah.
Suicide Squad, Warner Brothers just gave a similar statement. But I was kind of loosely excited for this film until I saw this trailer.
Oh, really?
I'm honestly more excited for Suicide Squad than I am for Superman Batman.
Oh, wait. I thought you meant it got you less excited. No, you're saying it got you more
excited. It got me more excited.
Okay, that's the word. That's the buzz I've heard from most people.
Yeah. Mostly because the detail right now, like, just the visual style, at least I'm getting from the trailer, is making me very happy because it seems a little formulaic, like it's following the Arrow, you know, Justice League converging.
Right.
Like, this is where DC is in our visual mind right now. But also in the sense that it's like, there are no superheroes in this movie. It's tight.
Yeah.
But other than Suicide Squad, the only major thing I wanted to talk about from Comic-Con is Game of Thrones related.
Oh, what?
Did you read anything about that?
No, okay. I did not hear anything
about
that.
So, this is the first Comic-Con appearance without David Benioff,
right,
or D.B. Weiss,
right,
as well as George R.R. Martin. Kit Harington was not there, of course.
Right.
And which is funny, considering the fact that, like, almost 2 years in a row, Khal Drogo, who died in season one, has been there. But it was arguably the most secretive Comic-Con panel, a secretive and sarcastic Comic-Con panel ever.
So what did it contain?
Well, for me, the big thing about it was it says something that the creators weren't there to me. I forget which executive producer was there, but I was expecting major, major news right now at Comic-Con.
I was
expecting some type of interesting announcement versus now we're stuck analyzing why there wasn't some sort of interesting announcement.
Well, no, didn't they make an announcement that Stannis is dead and Jon is dead?
They confirmed that, but
spoilers.
they didn't confirm that Jon was dead.
Okay.
They straight up said Stannis is dead.
There was the whole press release about him telling the president. I mean, that's really...
As
much as it could just be publicity, you could not make any harder push to tell the nation or the Game of Thrones watchers that, like, Jon Snow is actually dead as, like, look, guys, the writer told the President of the United States.
Like,
That, to me, was really trying to drill that in.
I don't think he's dead.
Okay.
But I am incredibly frustrated with the whole process, but I guess that's a part of being a fan of the series as well as the books. really hope George R. R. Martin finishes that book in early 2016 before season 6 comes out. And we'll end it with, if anything, this Comic-Con panel. I love Natalie Dormer now. Actress who plays Marjorie Tyrell.
Funny?
She was just hilarious. As well as, I think she was also pretty funny during the Hunger Games Catching Fire Part 2 panel. So, honestly, not my favorite Comic-Con compared to past years, but interesting stuff, and frankly, there's so much buzz all the time on the internet.
Is it over already?
Yeah. It ended. It's only a weekend.
Oh, I thought it was a week.
No. It's usually 4 days, Thursday through Sunday.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Most of the major panels being Friday, Saturday, I think.
Got it. Okay.
Other than that, unless you watch The Walking Dead. Yeah. So, well, thanks for listening, guys. Did you have anything you wanted to end with today?
I think that's it.
Awesome. Well, I hope you're all still watching.
Oh, I do have one thing. Frank. It's
Oh, yeah, that's right. Frank.
His last name, it's like Simon or something. It's not
something memorable. Something European.
Yeah, but it's not a very memorable last name.
Okay,
Frank.
It's Frank. I don't know how. It's because Frank
as
probably
soon as you
is
say
the
it,
same.
I'm like, oh yeah, of course I can hear Kelly
like,
Riley calling
Frank. Yeah. All right. Well, great time to be watching television. Great time to be listening to podcasts. So thanks again for listening. If you still are at this point. If you've missed our previous episodes, they're all up on iTunes. Just look up Thoughtful BS with Nate and Tofu. But again, thanks for listening.
Yeah,
and
thank you guys.
You have a great lives whenever or whatever point in your time
you're
listening to us.
All right.
Take care.